This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we are covering A Game of Thrones, with chapters from the point of view of Catelyn, Jon, and Eddard. In these chapters, Catelyn makes it to King's Landing, Jon is going through boot camp, and Ned is way over his head already. He has barely set foot in the place.
Yeah. I don't blame him. It just, he already doesn't want to be there, and then people are just like, oh, can we have a quick meeting? It's just, it's like when you're working, and then when you just start work, and it's like, can we have a quick meeting? And it's like, it's just gone 9 o'clock. What do you want?
I had my co-worker who's currently onboarding, she's pretty new, like the meeting was at 10, but she didn't get in until like near 10, and like she was so hangry. Hungry and angry. And I'm like, just eat the banana at the meeting. We don't care.
Yeah. It'll be okay. It's fine.
Yeah. But I digress. But we'll get to Ed's small council meeting. But first we start off with your favorite, Catelyn. Again, what were your feelings in regards to this chapter?
She's gullible. Gullible and stupid. That's what she is.
Yeah, gullible and stupid. And again, I just wish I knew more of the childhood dynamic between Catelyn and Baelish. I don't know. As much as people call him Littlefinger, I always think of him as Baelish.
Yeah, I mean, Littlefinger sounds weird, doesn't it?
It's a bit gross. And also, I have more respect for that actor.
Yeah. The actor, he's so good. Seems weird.
Yeah, he's been lots of stuff. Even before I really got into watching Game of Thrones, I was watching this adaptation of an Agatha Christie novel. I think it was Hercule Poirot, you know, mystery story. And the guy who ends up getting murdered, and they show the flashbacks, and I'm like, oh, that's Baelish.
Yeah. I did enjoy what happened to him in the end. Not gonna lie, because he's pretty scummy. But, the actor is great.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm really curious of what the dynamic was exactly to be able to see that between Catelyn and Baelish and Lysa by extension so that I could... that I feel like I would be in a stronger position to dictate just how much on the gullible scale is Catelyn being right now.
Yeah. Well, it does look like to me that they had a pretty good relationship from the fact that, well, I think she got the ick. Do you know what that means? Got the ick.
Yeah, she got the ick by the end.
Yeah, no, I think by the end of them living together when he went and like fought Brandon for her hand and whatever, and you know, I think that by the end she got the ick, but I think they had a pretty good, you know, relationship beforehand, you know, a brother and sister relationship in her eyes, that she feels like she can trust what he says and that he's truly on her side.
Yeah, and again, like, because the combination of the fact that she has not seen him since she married Ned.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not even she's, it's not like she's, you know, occasionally seen him at the, you know, annual conference or, you know, the, you know, intermingled at certain banquets or whatever. Yeah. She legitimately has not seen him since she married Ned. Mm-hmm. And the further context of that is, again, this whole story where Baelish decides he's going to fight Brandon Stark for her mm-hmm. hand, and obviously fails miserably. And then even afterwards, and then when Brandon dies, he sends mm-hmm. a letter. And I forgot that he had sent a letter and she didn't even read it, good for her.
Good for her, yeah, yeah. But that's where it comes, like, you know, that she got the ick then, you know.
Yeah, so
she was just like, you know, this guy that I saw as a brother, like, fancies me. It's just a bit weird, you know.
Yeah, the gullibleness comes from the fact that, you know, from that ick of things ending in a way very badly, mm-hmm. you know, at least on, you know, she. Again, maybe I'm giving her too much credit to have a certain level of emotional intelligence and compassion that even though it's ick, I still feel bad for him. But
yeah, no, I think so. Yeah, I think, look, unless it's John, okay, she is lovely to everyone else. She is lovely to everyone else. So yeah, unless it's John, it's just she does feel sorry for him. Well, felt sorry for him. And then, you know, those feelings of the friendship that they used to have and that camaraderie comes back.
Yeah, so I guess in terms of, again, her gullibility, I'm just surprised reading it again that she has this history with him where things ended ickily, mm-hmm. as we might say.
Yeah.
And the context of that, you know, things ending so badly things ending badly so many years ago, and the fact that she's not on her guard in the way that Baelish goes about bringing her. Instead, like, he should have just come in like a little hood, like, you know, mm-hmm. be a sneaky and like go to her tavern and talk to her if he was trying to imply, you know, like, Baelish's tactics. I don't understand how he thinks that's going to ingratiate himself.
Yeah, I think it's to show that, look how powerful I am now. I think it's one of those, you know?
I think it's one of those, again, for as much a certain level of emotional intelligence that Baelish has to have risen as well as he does, when it comes to, I guess, his blind spot of Catelyn, like, he's just so desperate to be like, look how powerful I am, because he doesn't see the nuances that, you know, she didn't just like Brandon or now Ned for just their pure bravery or power or whatever. Again, typical, typical Baelish, typical nice guy syndrome.
Yeah, yeah, I'm such a nice guy. Why didn't you pick me? I am such a nice guy, you stupid bitch. Why didn't you pick me?
Stay tuned for Peter Baelish versus Severus Snape.
Oh god, here we go. That's gonna be a fun one. I'm gonna rip into them so much.
So, well, first, before we actually get to Baelish, one thing I just noticed that, you know, from White Harbor, like, the boat they're on is called Storm Dancer, and I'm like, mm-hmm. what is this, My Little Pony?
I know, right? There's a head of a pony, actually, on the the ship.
And I've loved My Little Pony Friendship Biz Magic. I watched all 9 seasons. Like, I'm all for that. But it just seems so out of place in a Game of Thrones ship name.
I know. Well, you know, they put stupid names. Like, what was Joffrey's sword's name?
It's Widow's Wail.
How dumb.
Although that would be a very scary badass pony.
Yeah. Oh, we should make a fanfic about that.
Yeah, fanfic. Someone do that fan art of Widow's Wail, My Little Pony.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, love it.
Yeah. And then Oathkeeper would be so badass, like Brienne.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, I love Brienne. I can't wait till we get to her.
Yes, of course. Still another good 800 pages away. When you combine the books. But so yeah, Storm Dancer, My Little Pony ship sails in, and I really liked the cute little again, I have a friend who I was asking, like, hey, I'm reading Game of Thrones, and she's like, no, I ended up I really don't like George R. R. Martin's writing style. I'm reading Outlander and I'm like, well, Outlander's a good choice. But yeah, I just really like his writing style and getting the nice sort of scenic view of, you know, this image of the capital, you know, you know, on the harbor and, you know, the fish market and like all, you know, all things that go into like, you know, the country bumpkin entering the big city.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is. That is true. Yeah, it feels very, yeah, it is that sort of vibe that never left the country.
Yeah, and it's just interesting the notion of, again, relativity in terms of Southerner, because technically Catelyn is Southern enough where she considers the Norse so alien, but in terms of the overall Southern culture of Westeros, like, River Run isn't really, I feel like it's not really in on the whole, like, King's Landing, Storm End, the Reach, like, sort of Westerlands, like, that whole, like, I feel like that is, like, what I think of when I think of the South. Like, River Run is just in this weird middle where she doesn't feel good in the North, but she doesn't feel great in the South either.
Yeah, so a way that I could describe, I mean, you wouldn't know because you don't live here, so, but it's
sort of like, American.
Yeah, no, not a dumb American, no, it's like, it's sort of the geography, so if I think about it, I would say that, you know, River Run would be about, like, Northumberland is way up north. That's okay, where Winterfell would be.
Okay, that's too north. Okay, yeah. Sorry. But I do actually know a name.
Yes. Yes, you did. But it's, so like about Newcastle, sort of, you know, and then London would be King's Landing.
Yeah.
So that's where I think would be. So she's like, I think she's northerly enough.
Yeah.
To be, you know, the cultures are different.
Yeah, because honestly, I'm trying to think if she married, like, a more Southern husband, would the culture shock for her be worse? Or, like, honestly, I think she's better off with Ned in the North than, like, trying to make it in the Westerlands or the Reach if she had married someone there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe when she was younger, she would dream of someone from the South. Yeah, but it practicalities, I think it is more suited for her to have someone from the North.
Yeah. So yeah, they was the term make deck, or I don't know, ship in. I have no notion of seafaring terminology.
Oh, I used to work for a boat company. Hang on, they you know what? I can't think. I'm still sleep deprived. Yeah,
they dock.
They dock. That's it. They just dock.
Yeah. Okay, yep, so they get in, and again, this just reminded me of, like, my whole trip to Chicago, because it was the first trip I made post-pandemic, and so we were, it wasn't a big drive, it was driving 4 hours, but then having to park the car, give it to the valet, check into the hotel, and I'm just like, yeah, I know all of these things, and I was so, and trying to do everything so, so quickly, because all these, you know, city folk are like, move your ass!
Yeah. Yeah. Oh well, that's the same thing as London. It's just like, if you don't move quickly, people will angrily tut at you. They will just angrily tut at you. They won't say anything, but they will give you a side eye, an angry side eye, and an angry tut.
Yeah. Well, I would prefer in that way. I would prefer Londoners over New Yorkers.
I don't know about that.
Because New Yorkers would say something. But anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
So they get in to the tavern. You know, Catelyn takes a nap and again is woken up by the, like, by the gold cloaks or whoever they are, the city watch pounding on the door.
Yeah, so Roderick actually goes find the masters of the king. What is it? Masters of arms or something.
Arms.
Oh, the king's master of arms to look at the blade. So he goes. He thinks that he's going to be so inconspicuous. Because he doesn't have a beard anymore, so apparently he's so different. Well, to be honest, you know, sometimes you see people without their beards and it is a stark difference.
This is true, but it's less about his beard and more in the sense of, again, like, he has, like, certainly he hasn't been down south, I'm sure, in, like, a really, really, really long time and relying more on that than the beard. Even Ned hasn't been down south. Like, he's seen Robert, but it was only 9 years ago in regards to, like, the Iron Islands. It wasn't going down south.
Yeah, yeah, that is true. That is true. But that's where the, you know, the gullibility and the stupidness comes from. Because she knows that, you know, at least Varys has spies around. So, whatever happened.
Yeah, and in terms of, again, her level of, maybe this is a northern influence or something she always had, but again, her level of superstition in terms of attributing magical qualities to Varys. And not just that he's a spy master.
Yeah, that he's just, like, really tricky and, like, has people everywhere, eyes everywhere.
Yeah.
So in this world, I aim to be Varys.
Yes. Don't we all? So, she, so basically she kind of more or less gets dragged into, to see Baelish, and he was alone in the room, seated at a heavy woven table, an oil lamp beside him as he wrote. When they ushered her inside, he set down his pen and looked at her. "Cat," he said quietly. The whole dynamic of... I guess there's a disconnect I feel with... Clearly, he wants to put on, look how much power I have in the way that he has brought her before him. But at the same time, he's trying to play the, oh, we're old friends, we're buddy... We're buddy buddy, and I'm like, pick a lane. You gotta, like, doing both at the same time don't mesh.
No, no. I feel as well that he's, like, nagging a little bit. Her a little bit.
What's nagging mean?
So nagging is when you insult someone in a way where you're expecting them to like you at the same time. So lots of guys do it to women.
Like heckling, I guess.
Kind of, yeah, but it's not like you say it to someone, like, you know, face to face. So I'm trying to think of examples. It's kind of like a backhanded comment. So, like, oh, you're pretty for your age. So, you know, I feel like he's nagging her
about, left-handed compliment.
So, you know.
Yeah, so he... Yeah, I've angered my lady. That was never my intent. He looked contrite. The look brought back vivid memories for Catelyn. He had always been a sly child, but after his mischief, he always looked contrite. It was a gift he had. So again, it seems that intellectually, on some level, she understands the nature of Baelish, but emotionally, I don't know if it's just her, like, desperation and worry over the situation that is, like, I just need an ally. I just desperately need an ally, and I'm gonna cling to this guy, even though it may not be the most intellectually sound thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't see, I think, what Ned sees, that everyone in the South's a bit of a tricky dicky. So I think, there's another reason she's very gullible, is that she thinks she will find an ally down there. It's like, oh yeah, let's go down to the South and talk to the King's Master at arms to check the blade. It's like, what makes you think he's gonna tell you? What makes you think he's not gonna grass you up to someone else?
Yeah, and also, and again, in probably her arrogance of thinking that if he still, like, likes me in this way, I can use him to my benefit with having no context or any of her own resources to, So I think this is the very, this is the very first time where we see Lord Varys.
It is. Yeah, we've heard him mentioned before, but yeah, he comes in.
The man who stepped through the door was a plump, perfume powdered, and as hairless as an egg. He wore a vest of woven gold thread over a loose gown of purple silk, and his feet were pointed slippers of soft velvet. So, interesting. Like, I think it's supposed to be, you know, a description that shows him as very pompous. I don't know. In my imagining of Lord Varys, because I studied in Turkey and I understand the history of the Ottoman Empire and the role that eunuchs played in the administration of the harem, I don't see eunuchs as, you know, as cartoonish in that way. like, even with the description of his, like, the only cartoonish thing is plump, perfume, powdered, and hairless. Like, in terms of his clothing, like, I'm thinking, yeah, that's kind of would be something a eunuch in the Ottoman Empire would wear when yeah. he's managing everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like George R. R. Martin wanted to depict this vision of an effeminate man because of the silks and the perfume and stuff like that, when it's actually, if you're high in court, I'm sure that Littlefinger also smells good and has, like, nice silks, you know, but it's not being described as that. But because, you know, Varys is a eunuch, he doesn't have, you know, his bits, they are, you know, it is depicting him as some sort of, like, lady.
Like drag queen.
It's the same, it's the same way where, you know, I think me and you, we have talked about this before, the fact that sometimes we don't want to wear too much makeup, or we don't want to wear fake nails because people might see us as, you know, a certain type of person. And I think that's the same way. Let's say, like, he's being described as an effeminate man
mm-hmm.
when he isn't.
Yeah. And, but yeah, so we get, yeah, so they get the talk about, you know, the dagger, and basically Varys giggled like a little girl. Oh yes, I suppose I am guilty. I hope you forgive me, kind lady. I wonder if we might trouble you to show us the dagger.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, more little bit of banter, and Baelish admits that, oh, it's mine, but I lost it in a bet to Tyrion Lannister.
Hmm, interesting.
So yeah, this in the context of knowing what we know.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That Baelish started all of this in terms mm-hmm. of the assassination attempt. Did he, in the assassination attempt, did he instruct the assassin genuinely kill this kid, or just, like, put on a good show of killing it and, like, run away? Like, either way, it gets the result of, you know, instigating this feud. But I'm like, was he really going to kill Bran, or yeah?
I don't know. There are lots of questions in this in general about this. So, like, how far back was he planning this situation? Like, how does his brain work? Because, like, how far back did he, I don't, like, know, just
my theory, just thinking about it, is he decided to do something to stir up shit the minute he found out that Robert was gonna make Ned the Hand when Jon Arryn died.
Yeah, but wasn't the tourney. Wasn't the tourney before Jon Arryn died? So it's like, did he, so this are, like, all the questions that I have going on in my head, right? Was he planning on killing Jon Arryn, right, in the hopes that Robert would get Ned because they
killed Jon Arryn beforehand. Okay.
Yeah, and so I'm thinking, you know, was he already poisoning Jon Arryn? Was at the same time that he was trying to frame other people for it, and then cause this whole thing, this whole war? You know, it's just very complicated. I just wish we had something in his point of view.
Like, yeah,
a whole series of in his point of view, because he is such an interesting character. Because I want to know, like, what was his motivation for, like, wanting to kill Jon Arryn in the first place? Apart from being Lord of the Reach? Lord mm-hmm. of the something? Vale. The Vale, yeah. And, like, climb higher, gain favors with other people. I don't know. Yeah.
Like, yeah, because in terms of what the books, what we know is established in the books, is that he basically persuaded Lysa to be an accomplice in murdering Jon Arryn. And mm-hmm. and that he sent the dagger, right? That is confirmed, yeah. About that he sent the dagger in the books, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so those two things are confirmed in the books. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's basically like, he lost the dagger in a bet. Did he make that bet, you know, knowing that he was going to lose, so Tyrion would get the dagger? and then send a person to steal the dagger.
Yeah, I think...
to kill the kid.
Well, I think the way Baelish works is he... again, in terms of planting these sort of pieces of evidence, yeah, I think he maybe didn't know exactly how it was going to relate to the Starks or, like, John Arryn and stuff, but I think he decided, okay, I'm going to get rid of this dagger and give it to Tyrion Lannister. So if ever I need to pin anything on Tyrion Lannister, I have that in my inventory. Even though I don't know exactly how I'm going to use it now, I now have this weapon that's now tied to Tyrion Lannister, and I'll use that if I need it.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes much sense, because, like, how further into the future can he see?
Yeah, I don't think, yeah, it's even so impossible to see that far in the future. I think he's just putting so many, he's, like, scattering about so many, like, little investments and resources so that as things happen, he can call upon them.
Mm-hmm. All I can see in my head is when the War of the Seven Kings starts, he's that meme of that little girl that is, like, smirking at the camera while the house burns in the background.
Oh dear.
That's literally him.
Oh yes, indeed. And then we move on from your least favorite to absolute favorite, John.
Yeah.
Poor John. You know, basically it's boot camp training. I hate Alistair Thorne. He's a prick.
A huge prick, yeah. Yeah.
Ultimate prick. And at first I thought maybe in this chapter, is it this where we get Samwell? But not yet.
No. Mm-mm. I think he comes in a little bit later.
Yeah, a little later.
Yeah, maybe next chapter. Next strong chapter. Maybe he'll be there already.
Uh-huh, and then, so yeah, he's just trying to adjust, and I'm just thinking, why does Thorne have it in for John so much compared to, like, the others? It's like, why does Snape have it in for Harry? Why is John especially offensive
to Well, we all know why Snape have it in. Yeah, we all know why Snape has it in for Harry. He's a fucking petty cunt.
So. Yeah. Yeah, but yeah, we don't know that at the beginning, but yeah, we don't know that beginning, but yeah. But what is Thorne's deal?
Yeah, so I think it's because John came in and then started fighting like he was already, you know, like he's very knowledgeable already, and I don't think he likes that. I think he's just like, oh yeah, this cocky shit, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's, because the only thing I really remember about Thorne's background is that he was from a noble family, but got sent to the wall because his specific family, and he fought on the Targaryen side until the end, and that's why he's at the wall. So he is coming from all these, like, highborn prejudices about highborn and lowborn and bastards and things like that. So yeah, so that combined with the fact that John actually is one of the better cadets right now is just recipe for disaster. Yeah.
Really grinds his gears.
Yeah, and just John describing it as so cold. Like, do you prefer to be hot or cold?
Cold, 100%. But not that kind of cold either. So not like winter cold. So October is my favorite month. So I'm so happy right now that we are in October. And the weather's cooling down. And now I'm going to start my 31 days of horror films.
Yay!
That I watch every day of October. My boyfriend is thrilled. But anyway, I like October, November sort of weather when it's not too cold just yet, but it is cooler. I don't like extremes of either.
Yeah, I guess in terms of, I'm not talking about, oh, it's a nice breeze or, oh, it's a nice bit of sun. Like, would you, if it's uncomfortable, would you prefer to be uncomfortably hot or uncomfortably cold? They're both uncomfy. But genuinely, which would you prefer?
Uncomfortably cold. Because you can do things to warm up. Like, you can run around, you can start cleaning, you know. You can do all of those things. So with it being hot, there's no way to cool down. There's just no way to cool down.
Unless you jump in the water.
What? Oh, yeah, that's true. But the water gets warm. the water gets warm. So,
yeah, you know. So I think I would prefer to be uncomfortably hot, just because, and especially in comparison to my husband and I can withstand heat much more than he can. He'll be like, oh, I'm like sweating buckets, and I'm just like, oh, it's a little sticky, but it's not that bad.
So you're telling us that you are Targaryen then? You are the blood of the dragon.
Yes, I am. And my husband doesn't understand how hot the water can be when I take a shower.
Oh yeah, that's really funny. Like, it's a thing that men. So I like really hot showers as well.
It's a stereotype. My boyfriend.
Yeah, my boyfriend. So, you know, if we go to a place where you have to, you know, regulate the water and you just leave it, I leave it and then he puts it on. He's like, "What's wrong with you?"
Yes, there's Israeli artist. He does some cartoons about just daily life with his wife, and he has one cartoon of his wife in the shower, and she's just like, ah, and he's next to her, and he's like, ah, and like his skin is peeling off, and you can see his
muscle. My god, I think I know, it's the guy with the beard, right? The guy with the beard, and they had a baby like a couple of years ago or something. I remember that cartoon is really funny.
Yeah, so, but anyway, we get, you know, boot camp, and John's, you know, feeling kind of sorry for himself, and he's reminiscing on, you know, Benjen, his last conversation with his uncle, because Benjen went out rangering, and he wanted to go, and he said, no, you're training, you're not ready, and John is just like, I'm 15, almost a man grown, and I'm thinking, well, especially compared to teenagers now, like, you know, in terms of some... You know, to be fair, like, again, it's a spectrum, you know, some are more mature than others, but, like, generally just seeing, you know, because I work in a university in terms of, like, undergraduate students, like, sometimes I don't even think of, with a certain bad group, I don't even think of them as, like, college students, I don't even think of them as high schoolers, sometimes I even just think of them as middle schoolers.
Yeah, you are literal babies, like, you, the way that you act... doesn't matter how old you think you are, you are not that.
And then to be fair, Alexander the Great was kind of doing really big shit when he was just 16.
Back in those days, I guess you'd needed to mature much faster. I mean, teenagers didn't come in the term being a teenager didn't come into play until the 50s, wasn't it, like after the war.
The exact term teenager, but just the whole notion of adolescence, didn't come into being until like late 19th, early 20th century, in terms of like after the Industrial Revolution and thinking, oh, that maybe kids should be in school instead of in the factories working.
So, you know, it is very easy to see that you are man grown when you're 16, because the behaviors weren't the same, you know, back then.
Right.
Back then, in the second century. Something that it really kind of jarred me a little bit in this chapter, and I love John, but John, a little bit prejudiced against these people. I know that I know that most of them are criminals, but a passage on this that says there was almost 20 in the group he trained with, yet not one he could call a friend. Most were 2 or 3 years his senior, yet not one was half the fighter Rob had been at 14. And then he says the more time he spent with them, the more John despised them. So because they aren't as good a fighter, and he's comparing it to Rob, like, no one's gonna be like Rob. You know, he's just comparing their abilities to Rob, and he just hates them for it.
Yeah, and I think, and it's trying to prop himself up, because he is trying to reconcile this disillusionment that has been brought forth by Tyrion in terms of what the exact nature of the Night's Watch is, because he was just naively thinking it's all going to be a bunch of Benjen Starks, and that's just not the case. Yeah, both in terms of morality or like social status, it's just going to be a hodgepodge of absolutely everything. Yeah. And you know, I think, you know, in this selfish way, the thing he's taking comfort in is the fact that I'm the best fighter.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I feel like he resents. Well, I don't feel. I know because it says here. You know, he resents his uncle and he resents his dad. You know, because he says here. John wondered if his father had known what the war would be like. He must have. He thought that only made it hurt worse. So, but it's just like people have tried to warn you. You know, Benjen has said, you know, you need to lead a life.
Yeah. Yeah, only Benjen said, like, yeah, like, he can be, yeah, he can't be mad at Benjen, because Benjen, like, told it to him straight. But Ned, I can understand, and, you know, it makes sense that he's angry with Ned, because, again, Ned wasn't willing to, like, fight with Catelyn, to be like, he's gonna stay here, and you're gonna like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think he thought she mistreats him so much that the wall will be a breeze. You never know.
Mm-hmm. Do you hear that bird?
I do. I do. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
I don't know what's going on. Okay, he's going away. He flew away. Okay.
Can still hear him.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Mormont's crow, Karn. Karn.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you need to give him corn.
So, yeah, so he has no respect for any of his fellow cadets, and they end up kind of ganging up on him, but still he beats the crap out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does, because he is a better fighter than them. You know, mm-hmm. even though he started, but then he gets the blame.
Yep, and then I really like this sort of talk that the Master of Arns, what's his name?
Donal Noy.
Noy, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, Donal Noy, good on him. Very woke. He is sort of very woke for a Master of Arms up in the north in the middle of nowhere in a medieval period.
Very wise. So wise. Yeah, it's almost unheard of.
Yeah, and so he's just laying it out that, look, you're a castle-bred bastard. You had a Masters of Arms at Winterfell to teach you. These guys haven't. How do you think that makes them feel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's like they hate you because you act like you're better than they are. You're not, he says, you're a Snow, not a Stark. You're a bastard and a bully. Damn, just lay it on John.
Yeah.
Yeah, John has been acting like a brat. And, you know, in this chapter, mm-hmm. and I'm guessing since he got there. So he needed to be put in his place. Like, he was behaving like a lord. That's why people call him Lord Snow. So he was behaving like that. So...
And it's just interesting, this notion of Donnell's, like, again, John is so much, you know, incensed and insulted by the bully accusation. Mm-hmm. And Donnell's like, they were the ones who came at me, four of them. Four that you humiliated in the yard. Four who are probably afraid of you. I've watched you fight. It's not training with you. Put a good edge on your sword and they'd be dead meat. You know it. I know it. They know it. You leave them nothing. You shame them. Does that make you proud? Which is just interesting, the notion of, you know, for this solely masculine environment where stereotypically toxic masculinity is thriving on competition and things like that. You know, the fact that Donal is advising John to be like, you do need to think about things beyond just winning. Like, there is some emotional intelligence that's required here.
Yeah, definitely. It's like he's been fighting these kids. He's taking out all his resentment from being on the wall at these kids that, and he associates them with being a part of the wall instead of these individuals that have come there and they don't know anything else. They don't know much about life. Either. Well, not that John knows anything about life, but like they haven't had the training that he had. And it, you know what, good on Donal for raising
like
up
some of them can't even read, like it's a oddity that John can read.
It's you know, I said this before, that I thought that maybe John had the intelligence to think, you know, that he was lucky because he kind of knew that all the bastards weren't treated the same way. But I don't, now I take that back. Now I think that he might not have
I think he understood at a very superficial intellectual level, but did he truly, truly grasp it emotionally? No, he had not yet.
No.
Yeah. But so yeah. Good on you, Noi. Woke Noi. Hashtag woke Noi.
Hashtag woke Noi.
And so John goes up and does what he does best, brooding.
Yeah.
Love to see Kit Harington brooding.
I know. I love it. That was like one of the interviews that he gave that is like, he was actually brooding because it was so cold where he was, and he never got to film in the warm places. So he was just like, he was genuinely so grumpy about that, and like, he would complain so much. I think Sophie Turner and Maisie Williams said that he moaned, he was worse than all the girls there, because he would moan about everything, like from being too cold and like about his hair and
And then brooding John is joined by Tyrion Lannister. So, and they just, well, and we got, before Tyrion joins, like we get the sort of like history that like it, the just showing the true decline of the Wall and the Night's Watch. Mm-hmm. And there's only three towers that are currently in use that are occupied: Castle Black, East Watch, and Shadow Tower. The rest of the other, you know, 16. There's 19 altogether. The remaining 16 are just completely abandoned and not used. And again, I don't know, was it the sense that the wildlings, like it was more of a hassle to keep the wildlings out? Because now at this point, I don't know, I don't remember the exact history, again, the nature of, like, the wildlings and how much they were trying to get down south. Now they're trying to get down south, and we know why, but...
Yeah. I don't know. I think, it's just... It's weird, because crime doesn't seem to be stopping, but they are not being sent to the Wall. They're being, what, put in prisons or being killed or something like that. So I don't think it's, you know, less of a hassle to... you know, get rid of the wildlings. It's more they don't have the manpower, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Tyrion's just, you know, kind of mocking just the state of the whole Night's Watch and Castle Black, and is like, no, Tyrion Lannister, laughter steamed in the cold air. I'll be sure to tell your father to arrest more stonemasons before your tower collapses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. They really need some help. They really need some help just to build. Maybe it's because since Robert came into the throne, they've been declining, because Robert just doesn't care. Maybe that's why no one's being sent up north.
Yeah, I don't know exactly where I read it. I was given the impression that it's been like a couple generations since, you know, the Night's Watch has been in decline, but. Anyway, and John is just like, I'm better than I'm by myself, said John stubbornly. The rest of them are scared of Ghost.
Poor you, John.
Poor you, I such a misunderstood, angsty teenager.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is that time of of his life, isn't it? That's when things start getting really annoying.
Yeah. And they finally go in and have some dinner, and John, like... Mm-hmm. is eyeing Gren and Toad like the others, thoughtfully thinking, should I join them? But he's like, no, I'm gonna be an emo teenager and sit by myself in the corner of the cafeteria.
With Tyrion, I guess, like, with he's my only friend.
Tyrion, the imp from the Lannister imp, is my only friend in this world.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, he's so sulky. He's so annoying. I do love John, but
although again, like, you know, there's a, you know, there's the balance between complaining and venting. Like, I'm okay with people venting to me about crappy things in their life if I know that they are genuinely taking steps to improve their situation, whether directly or indirectly. If you're complaining about something and you're not doing anything to fix it, like I knew someone who was complaining to me, like, about their roommate situation, and I'm like,
while you're looking for new things like that. And like they were doing absolutely nothing to help themselves. Mm. And I'm like, okay, you're doing nothing to help yourself. This isn't venting. This is complaining. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, sometimes people just like to moan, like to have a moan, which is fine. But when it's constant and mm-hmm. it's just a bit annoying. Yeah, but John's being a little bitch, to be honest.
Yeah, John's being a little bitchy. And
yeah, and then Alistair Thorne comes over and he's just like, you know, the Lord Commander wants to see you. And John's like, what about? And he's like, I'm not going to tell you.
Just a stupid power trip.
Yeah. And then Tyrion comes to his rescue and he's, you know. Well, Lannister goes to him and says, stop it, Thorne. You're frightening the boy. And then he says, keep out of matters that don't concern you, Lannister. You have no place here. And then Tyrion goes, I have placed a court, though. A word in the right ear. And you'll die a sour old man before you get another boy to train. I love that. He's just like, he's really nice. Just, you know, just standing up for his friend like that.
And wielding his power for good. Because, again, he gets so mocked in, like, you know, his normal settings. But in this place where, again, the prestige of Night's Watch has declined, like, he has all the power in this situation mm-hmm. as like, an esteemed guest.
Yeah.
Yep. And so it's about Bran, and Jon is like besides himself. He just immediately runs mm-hmm. into Lord Commander's office, doesn't even like, you know, stand on ceremony, and it's like, is he alive?
Yeah. Before that though, so Tyrion says, you know, that says here, Tyrion laid a hand on his arm. John, he says, I am truly sorry. So that makes it seem like he knows something. Mm-hmm. He knows something because he's already, like, giving his condolences to John. So mm-hmm. it's to trick us into thinking that he actually did sin that person because he knows something that, mm-hmm. you know, John doesn't know, which is, you know, the kid's dead. But it's actually, you know, he saw how bad he was. And he just mm-hmm. predicted that he had died. Like, no one would have ever thought that he would come back from that.
John is the only one of everyone so far, like, you know, like Jamie and like other people, you know, again, in this, you know, ableist, prejudiced world, you know, a lot of people are of the mind that, especially for a mm-hmm. boy, for a young man, that it would be better to have a clean death than to, like, live out your life as a cripple. And so John is really breaking that sort of sentiment by he's just so happy that Bran is alive.
Yeah, that, to him, all that matters is that Bran is alive. Doesn't matter how he is, but that he's just alive, and people are just, you know, acting like it's worse than him being dead.
And I forgot that Jon literally lifts Tyrion up in the air and is like swinging him around, and because he's so happy, and he's like, Bran's gonna live.
Yeah, that's so cute. It's so sweet.
Yes, it is so sweet. And then,
he goes up to, you know, Gren, and he apologizes for
trying to offer the olive branch of, you know, mm-hmm. Rob used that same move on me. You know, it hurt. Like, I can show you how to defend it. And again, Alistair Thorne is like, Lord Snow wants to take my place now, he sneered. Mm. I have an easier time teaching a wolf to juggle than you will training this Aldrux. I'll take that wager, Sir Alistair, John said. I'd love to see ghosts juggle. And everyone laughs and
breaks the tension, really. And then it shows that John's not actually an arsehole.
Yeah, John's not an arsehole. And Sir Alistair is just not here for it. And it's, again, I guess he's just, again, it's an inverse form of flattery. That Alistair sees so much potential in John because, you know, at first glance you would think, oh, if the better one is willing to take his time with the ones that are not as good, it'll make my life easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he doesn't perceive it that way.
No, of course not. Because he hates John, so everything that John does
is wrong.
It is wrong, and it's not good enough.
That was a grievous error, Lord Snow, he said, and at last the acid tones of an enemy. Yeah, again, can't please everyone. Because in John's case, it's not like Alistair liked him and, like, being the teacher's pet was an option for him. Alistair already hated him, and him anyway, he was good, so he might as well get allies with Gren and the others.
Yeah.
And now we move on to Eddard. Eddard mm-hmm. sets foot in King's Landing. He doesn't even go have a rest at the Tower of the Hand. He immediately has to go into a small council meeting.
Yeah, he's already finding it hard to assert himself in the South. Like, this person came in and he's just like, yeah, they want an urgent meeting with you. And then he says, it'll be convenient in the morrow. And then the steward goes and says, I'll let them know that, you can meet tomorrow. And he's just like, damn it. No, I'll go see them now. And it's like, you're already having a hard time, my son.
Yeah. We get Renly, which Ned is commenting how much Renly looks like Robert. Again, I like Renly. Renly's a good dude. Like, I don't interpret his pompousness in the same way as incompetence, the way some readers do. At least at this point. At least at this point, because I guess I don't know if the books there was a scene like this at all. But there, in the show, there was a scene between Robert and Renly, like about them out hunting and, Robert, like, reveling in the glory days of war and all his battles. And Renly was just like, yeah, with all the orphans and the crying widows. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I love him. He's very blunt. He's very, yeah, I wish he would have lived a bit longer.
Yeah, such a pity. So we've got, the counselor Ned liked least, the eunuch Varys. Again, you can hate Pycelle, hate Baelish, or, like, you're gonna go for Varys to hate the most.
I know, just because he has spies everywhere. It's like he doesn't understand the asset that he is. Intelligence, what we were talking about in the bonus episode, the scholarly slither clause, everything about war and ruling, it's intelligence beforehand, and you need to put all those things in the first place to be able to succeed and plan before you put something in a plan in place. And he just really hates that for some reason.
Yeah, it's like, it's because, again, the notion of intelligence and spymaster, that intelligence and intelligence gathering, that in itself is a neutral, like, trait or characteristic, and so to automatically assign evil to it, in the same way that Slytherin traits of cunning and ambition are, at on first sight, very neutral traits, but because they directly do not scream honor and valor, they're labeled as bad.
Yeah, precisely.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a little small council meeting, and it's interesting because we were talking about Varys, how he looked to, like, Catelyn. And, what was it? Ned saying Renly looks so much like Robert, and he's like a poor copy. Though much better dressed, said Littlefinger. There are worse crimes, said Renly with a laugh. The way you dress, for one. Likes.
Yeah. Yeah. He just roasting everyone. Yeah. I love him.
Yeah, well, because, he just throws it back at everyone who gives it to him.
Yeah. And then this, this very urgent meeting that must be had right there and then. Because they want to put a tourney
in honor of Ned's ascension as Hand of the King. Like, I understand PR is important. PR is important, but let the guy sleep.
I know. It's just ridiculous, and it's not urgent. It's stupid.
Again, it's described as Robert wants this done as soon as possible, because I think, again, like, tournaments and, like, playing at war are the only things he kind of finds joy in at this point. So I guess I kind of, Robert hastening and pretending that this managing and organizing this tournament is so important, it reminds me of, like, I have a big event that I'm going to be hosting tonight. It's the big Arabic dinner for all the students in our program, and it'll be really fun. And I'm also thinking about other events that I'm going to be programming, but one thing I'm really, really interested is like trying to help plan a photo exhibit, like, with a photo contest from the students, and I'm really passionate about that. So I'm like saying like, oh, this is really important, but it's my personal like prejudice and, you know, passion. So I think, yeah, Robert is like, oh, this is one of the few things that I can actually enjoy as king. Get it done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. But, you know, won't come cheap.
Won't come cheap. And I remember, I don't know why, but just Sean Bean's delivery of, like, I will not believe that John Arryn allowed Robert to beggar the realm. He just, I don't know what specifically about that, but just the way he delivered that was just so great.
Yeah, yeah. He's just such a great actor. He embodied, you know, Ned completely. There's actually a behind the scenes where, you know, D&D said to Sean Bean if he could make his accent a bit more southern, and he just went no. So then everyone in the cast had to change their accents to match Sean Bean's accent. Well, all of his children anyway had to match his accent, and that's so funny to me.
Well, it wouldn't make sense for him to have a southern accent anyway. In this context, yeah, but particularly this fantasy series based off England.
Yeah. I think it's because they wanted it to be more friendly to, I guess, an American audience.
It's Sean Bean.
But I don't think it's that bad.
Like, it never, like, they're, like, the only person I think of is, like, my dad, who is getting on in years, and he has a real hard time with, like, heavy Irish and Scottish accents. But apart from him, the majority, like, we can take it.
They really don't think that their audience
I really hate when like producers and directors like don't trust their audience to get it and just want to spoon feed things.
But yeah, we find out that, you know, the crown is more than 6 million in debt, which is fantastic.
Is like, what? And like, yeah. Well, first, we just think it's 3 million, and that's just all that's that they owe the Lannisters. And it's a combination of the Iron Bank, Lord Tyrell, and even Tyroshi trading cartels, and even the Vatican at this point.
Yeah, yeah. They are just, what the hell did Robert do in 15 years?
Absolutely. So they could be so much that.
Because, yeah, well. Yeah, that's true. Because they had, so much money, because the Targaryens left a bunch of money when they got dethroned. And so he spent, like, a shitload of that money and then started borrowing from other people.
Yeah, he already spent it. Like, because I'm thinking the only truly major expense I can think of in Robert's reign was dealing with the Iron Island Rebellion. But other than that, I don't think anything else really... In terms of huge expenses of war, I don't think he had that much.
No, it's just he's spending it on whoring, drinking, and tournaments. Yeah.
Good thing Robert is not in charge of the multi-million dollar grant I manage for the federal government.
Jesus Christ. It would be party after party after party.
Yeah. Arabic dinner after Arabic dinner.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, the Master of Coin finds the money, the king and the hand spend it.
So, it just feels like Ned was trying to put blame on Littlefinger for the debt instead of Robert, because he's still trying to see, he still sees Robert as that friend that he had 15 years ago and not the person that who he is right now.
Yeah, because there is the nature of, like, in my position, like, my budget management isn't my major component, but it is a component of my position. And so, but definitely, like, I have another coworker, Alonzo, and he's definitely more the financial guy. And it's like, you know, Ned is expecting Littlefinger to behave the way I expect my coworker and my buddy Alonzo to behave, to say, like, if something is going wrong in the budget, he's supposed to tell me, and then we can work something out. I think Ned is, again, seeing Robert as his friend, but also I think coming into this thinking that even though Robert is a king, that there should be these guardrails in place, and there just wasn't anything.
Yeah. He's surrounded by flatterers and people who can't say no to
him. And even John Arryn wasn't enough, because Robert was just blowing all this money when John Arryn was alive. So not even John Arryn was a guardrail, a guy that Robert actually respected.
Yeah. He's just completely out of control.
I equate it to like compulsive gambling.
Yeah, it's one of those. I think that he was so devastated about Lyanna's death that he just going through the motions, I guess, and spending more and more and more.
Yeah, and Ned is just like, we ain't doing shit until I talk to Robert about this, you know?
And Rand is like, good luck.
Yeah, good luck with that. And then Ned's just reflecting on, you know, how upset Sansa was when Lady died, and then Arya, who's just so bitter now, and just like, what the hell did I do?
Yeah. He's like, he says, and Eddard Stark dreamed of a frozen hell to reserve for the Starks of Winterfell. He just wants to be back. He's just like, I've made a grave mistake coming down here. It's all like gone wrong for now.
And
so far,
And Littlefinger grabs Ned right after the small council meeting and lures him over to one of his brothels.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't the place to my chambers. It's like, no, did I say it was? I'm leading you to the dungeons to slit your throat and seal your corpse up behind a wall. That's very Edgar Allan Poe from like The Black Cat.
Mm.
Did you read that short story?
No.
Well, it's
which is funny because I like creepy things.
Yeah, well, in that particular one, the guy goes crazy. You don't know if it's alcoholism or whatever, but it gets to a point where he murders his wife and he seals up her body, you know, in the wall.
Wow. Yeah. Fucking hell. Okay.
So, yeah, they end up going to one of Baelish's many, quote-unquote, establishments.
Mm-hmm. And he gets really offended because he says
your wife.
Yeah, he's like, oh, your wife's in there. He's like, the fuck did you say to me?
And is like about to like slit his throat. And then who comes to the rescue? Sir Roderick.
Yeah. Sir Roderick Waddling. Comes over. It's like, no, he's telling the truth. You know, please.
Yeah. So we get the reunite. I don't know. I'm curious about Ned and Catelyn's relationship, just in this current rereading of realizing, again, viewing Catelyn more negatively in terms of, like, how do these two people like each other or care about each other at this point? And
I think they have to make do. I guess, like, when you spend more time with someone,
it can go both ways.
You can either hate them a lot or you can like them a lot. And I think for them it worked out very well. It's just kind of like he doesn't want to rock the boat with her being a bitch. And then she's just like, okay. They seem very different, don't they?
Yeah, they seem very different. And again, also trying, as you said, that once you get Catelyn out of the vicinity of Jon Snow, she can be a relatively normal person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But for most of his life, he has seen her being a horrible person to Jon. So,
It's interesting. So she updates him on everything that has happened. And because Summer saved Bran, Ned now feels even worse about killing Lady.
Yeah, because he's just like, he flashes back to when Jon said that, you know, his kids were meant to have those wolves. So he feels really bad because, you know, they bring protection to them, which is sad. It's really sad. Yep. I mean, what could he have done, really?
Yeah. And so, what is there? Basically suggesting that Tyrion Lannister would send this assassin with his dagger.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, why would they want Bronn dead? The boy has never done him harm. Do you Starks have naught but snow between your ears, Littlefinger asked. The imp would never have acted alone. So basically, again, implying that this is a wider Lannister plot and, you know, more than likely Robert would not be involved.
Well, but then before that, he did think, oh my god, what if Robert was behind it? What if he knew? And he's already seen Robert as sort of the enemy. He's starting to see, like, that is a possibility that he could have done that. And then he brings up the, you know, because he's thinking, you know, about the, you know, Robert's talk of sending hired knives after the Targaryen princess. He remembers Rhaegar's infant son, the red ruin of his skull, and the way the knight, the way that the king had turned away, as he had turned away from Daenerys' audience hall not so long ago. So when, you know, he turned away from Ned, when Ned begged him not to, you know,
make him kill Lady.
Yeah, and he says he could still hear Sansa pleading as Lyanna had pleaded once. So it's all matching up, you know?
And I think, in some ways, I think Ned is now more paranoid. First, from seeing that how bloodthirsty Robert is for Targaryen blood, obviously that naturally makes him more paranoid about Jon.
Mm-hmm.
Jon, yeah. And worrying about, like, you know, if... And I think, you know, maybe in his mind, he's like, oh my god, what if, like, he sent an assassin for Jon and, like, and the guy accidentally, like, went for Bran?
Mm, yeah. Isn't it curious? Curious how he's already mistrusting his friend?
Yeah. So, and then, like, we have proof, Ned said. We have the dagger. The dagger is not circumstantial, Your Honor.
He's just stupid. They are just stupid up there.
Yeah, it's just, again, different political culture. That's all I can say. And yeah, and it's just interesting, the notion of, again, what constitutes proof and what doesn't, and how that changes. And, you know, hopefully as time goes on, the justice system, we're more scrutinizing. Because, again, I think I've mentioned I was reading a book about the library in Los Angeles that burned down. And it was at the point where a lot of people were like, yeah, we know this guy did it, but technicality and its extent and it's all circumstantial, technically we can't convict him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though everyone, like, basically knew, yeah, this was the guy who did it. And he did it for, like, stupid attention-seeking reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so no, we can't, dagger's not enough, and, you know... Littlefinger is trying to say, like, I would just, you know, get rid of that knife and just, like, go about your business and not try to... Well, I guess he's doing it just to rile Ned up so that he'll want to... It's like, don't touch that or don't look at it. You just want to look at it now.
The minute
you tell someone, don't do it, they're immediately going to not want to do it. Or tell them, don't do it, they're immediately want to do it. Like anti-vaxxers.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Isn't it funny how they are, isn't it? They didn't want to wear masks, you know, before, because of, like, oh yeah, it's intruding our freedom. And then, but they also don't want to get vaccinated because they don't want to wear masks.
That's why I get really confused by, because again, in terms of opening up the economy and stuff and having things go back to normal, you should be pro-masks because that's the surest way to get things to go as to normal as possible. But still, it's like, no, they just don't want to admit to, like, changing absolutely anything about how they live their lives. And again, it just comes off as really like, what are you, 5 years old? Just do it.
Yeah. Throwing tantrums. Pathetic. You are all pathetic. Get over it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, Ned's just like, I'm not going to throw that in the river. Like, you are, if you believe that you are, you know, a bigger fool than when you took arms against my brother. And then Littlefinger just serves the burn. And he's just like, you know, fool, I may be Stark, yet I'm still here, while your brother has been mouldering in his frozen grave for some 14 years. Ouch. Burn. But then you kind of see, you know, like, Littlefinger is clever.
Again.
And he knows he's clever too.
Yeah, honor versus self-preservation, the age-old dilemma.
Yeah.
And so we go, what is basically their game plan? They're just going, you know, Ned's just going to continue what he was already going to do because of Lysa letter, like, investigate. And he tells Catelyn to go home. And he's like, mm-hmm. oh, and she's like, oh, I wanted to see the girls. And unfortunately, fortunately, Ned says, no, you can't. It's too risky, like, for them, anyone else to see my wife here.
Yeah. Well, Littlefinger says that, and then, you know, he agrees.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they have a moment alone.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it? And he's basically, smart thing, he's basically telling her, like, get all the bannermen ready. Have them yeah. fortify White Harbor. Like, have them do, have them just be ready if war happens. You know, one of the few mm-hmm. smart things he's doing in processing yeah. this new information, because he's realizing that at some point it's very possible for the shit to hit the fan.
Yeah, yeah. It's very volatile for him. Well, that is, you know, it is the Queen's brother. So, and he saw that that Robert took Cersei's side. Mm-hmm. So what would stop him from taking her side this time as well? Mm-hmm. He just doesn't know. Everything's just very volatile. So he's going to, you know, explore, and that can be, mm-hmm. that. I mean, Jon Arryn's, he's going to explore Jon Arryn's death, which could be also inflammatory for the Lannisters.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just, yeah, he needs to prepare, which is good.
Yep. Alrighty. And thus concludes Eddard's chapter. Again, the plot thickens.
I love it. I love it. We're getting to some real meat.
Yes, like, you know, I don't know how many, yeah, it took 170 pages to get to King's Landing, but we're there. But again, I enjoyed our time in Winterfell and on the King's Road. Things happened.
Me too. We should cherish those moments, because we won't have it again.
No, we never will.
No.
And now we move on to our history lesson. So, what'd you come up with?
So, I want to talk a little bit of the castles at the wall. Because much like the castles at the wall, we also had castles here. So, as we all know, Hadrian's Wall, sort of the inspiration for the wall. And, you know, it was protected England from the Scots. But there were also castles that protected, you know, England from raids from mm-hmm. the Scots. So while Game of Thrones, they had like 19 castles, it mm-hmm. wasn't that much here in England. Yeah. We had, you know, although the Hadrian's Wall had sort of garrisons, I think they're called.
Yeah. Yeah,
because the wall, Hadrian's Wall was, you know, went along the whole of the UK.
Yeah.
Well, the whole of England from coast to coast.
Right.
So they had garrisons in between them.
Yeah, but how many garrisons were there?
God, I don't know. I didn't do my research that well. Sorry. Okay, but I think there were about, from the top of my head, because when I went to Hadrian's Wall, we were looking which mm-hmm. one was going to be nearer to us. I think there's about 5 or 6. I think. Don't mm-hmm. quote me on that. But anyway, so yeah, while the wall has 19 strongholds, in England there were 3 castles that were built after the Norman conquest in order to stop the raids.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1072, Durham Castle was the first one that was built, followed in 1080 mm-hmm. by Newcastle, which that's where the town takes its name.
Newcastle.
It was just called Newcastle. And then finally, Carlisle Castle in the 1100s. There isn't really much evidence of when it was officially finished building, but mm-hmm. it was around the 1100s.
So we've got these three that are basically Shadow Tower, Eastwatch, and Castle Black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So Carlisle and Newcastle were built on the west and east coasts of England, respectively. And then Durham was built just below Newcastle, which I think is to catch anyone who has come through.
Yeah, anyone who actually made it that far.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's what I have. That's the inspiration was for the wall. What do you have?
I know. Yeah, I'll say in a minute. I just, when you said Hadrian's Wall, like, because, you know, in Athens, there's a ruin, Hadrian's Library, which I do have a picture of.
Yeah, yeah. It does make sense. Because, yeah, Hadrian was the person who has sort of conquered England at the time after the Romans, I think it was. Or before the Romans. Not really sure. But yeah, before the Romans. After the Romans. Whatever. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. We'll get there at some point.
So, I actually thought of the Janissaries. Have you heard of them?
No.
The Janissaries, so yeah, this is kind of a parallel going up north to the Night's Watch. It's not an exact parallel, but there are some overlaps. So, the Janissary Corps, like, they were basically a type of military in the Ottoman Empire. But the way they were recruited was the sense of, you know, the Ottoman Empire had all these, like, frontier territories. So literally they would go in and raid, like, certain Christian, you know, non-Islamic regions, you know, capture men and boys and force them to, you know, basically convert to Islam and basically force them to serve and be this sort of military unit.
Right.
So it was a way of using all the, like, riffraff and those, not necessarily riffraff, but just those on the outskirts of their kingdom and putting them to use. And so the Janissary Corps was originally staffed through devshirme, a system of tribute by which Christian youths were taken from the Balkan provinces, converted to Islam, and drafted into Ottoman service. Subject to strict rules, including celibacy, they were organized into three unequal divisions, Cemaat, Buluk Halk, and Segban, and commanded by an aga. In the late 16th century, the celibacy rule and other restrictions were relaxed, and by the end of the 18th century, the original method of recruitment had been abandoned, opening up the rank to Muslim Turks. The Janissaries were known particularly for their archery, but by the 16th century, they had also become a formidable firepower contingent. And the supreme prowess and discipline of the Janissaries allowed them to become increasingly powerful in the palace. From the reign of Bayezid II, from 1481 to 1512, they regularly required sultans to provide extra pay in exchange for the support of the corps. The maintenance costs of the army's force proved increasingly unaffordable for the empire, however, augmented the growing tensions between the Janissary and the sultan. And so, yeah, it's... So, yeah, not exact, like, in the Janissary case, it was very much a system where, again, like, sort of, like, this riffraff and just bringing in people from the outer territories and putting them to use to the state, and then they got more and more prestigious and more powerful to the point of, you know, the Sultan maybe being a little concerned about how powerful they were. And I don't remember exactly how they ended, but it ended, but the whole corps itself, like, ended kind of nastily in terms of, you know, the whole, you know, by, like, the 19th century, like, trying to figure out, like, how, like, are we going to be an empire? Are we going to be a democracy? You know, all those age of revolutions, like the Russian Revolution, all of that, trying to figure out what are we going to be? And the Janissaries represented this really old school way, and they ultimately were disbanded. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's what I thought of.
No, that's great. It's a great insight on how the Night's Watch could have come about as well. Yeah.
Because it's just interesting to compare, like, the Turkish model compared to this very feudal, like, European stuff that which we were, again, talking about when we were discussing Machiavelli and other things and the, you know, scholarly slither clause. But, yeah.
Yeah.
And now we move on to our friendship lessons.
So, as many times, I draw from Catelyn's stupidity as something for you not to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've got here, be aware of fake friends. Length of friendship does not equate to loyalty. So, just because you have a friend that has been there for a very long time doesn't mean that they are your most loyal friends.
Yeah.
Just be careful with that.
Yes. And even if they're just there, like, nominally on Facebook, that doesn't mean anything of substance there in terms of actually being your friend.
Exactly. Let me tell you a story. I had a friend for 10 years. 10 years we were friends. Then my aunt passed away. She took her own life. And, you know, obviously I told her she was my best friend. So I told her. She was like my longest friend that I've had, that I had here in the UK. So I told her, and she was at the time in uni doing dentistry, and she couldn't come see me because it was like near Christmas as well, so she was having end of term exams, and she said, but as soon as I come back, I'll come see you. So then she comes back and I don't hear anything from her, and I'm going through a really hard time, right? And then I messaged her and asked if she wanted to do something, and she said, oh no, I'm seeing this other girl. And then I was like, oh, okay, now that's fine, because it was very last minute. So I said, oh, I forgot that I had to, you know, book a time with my friends. But I didn't say in a nasty way. It was sort of like, haha, you know. And she thought that she was like, that's a really bitchy thing to say. And I was like, well, I didn't mean to be bitchy, and I'm not in the headspace to be bitchy right now. And then I've never heard from her again.
Yeah.
So beware of the people that are around you. You know, because if they're, even though they are your oldest friend, doesn't mean that they are
reliable or
loyal.
Yeah, I had a situation like that with a, you know, I went to a different high school. So, like, all my friends were in, like, elementary school and middle school were different. So we had this space where, you know, we didn't go to high school. And then I went off to college, and this one friend got in touch with me. And for a while, like, every time I would come home and visit, like, we would hang out and things like that. And, you know, I'd try. If, long story short, I think it was a situation that she needed me to be there for her when she was doing bad. But then when she was doing fine, she didn't see the need to invest in the friendship for me. And there was also, again, a similar thing where I was just like, hey, you want to hang out? Or we had planned to hang out and had a plan. And then she bailed out at the last minute and said, I have to work. And I just never spoke to her again.
Wow. That's, oh, people, right?
Yeah. My friendship lesson comes from John. John, basically, check your privilege.
Yes.
Very woke lesson, because, again, just the notion of, you know, the people around you in your social circle, regardless if they're a friend or an acquaintance, like, they're coming, all they can do is come at life from their own worldview and are limited by their own experiences.
This is taking the proper piss. Sorry. I heard the last thing is just the notion. That's what you said.
Okay. Yeah, just the notion of, you know, all people can do is see the world from their own worldview and their own experiences, and just always be mindful of that. And again, even if you're in a situation that maybe is trying to enforce a certain level of equality, but even still, maybe just even getting to that position, there are certain imbalances in terms of equity.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So yeah, that's my lesson.
Yay!
Alrighty then, and thus concludes this episode of, I was about to say Rambling Raven Puffs, but no, Podcaster's Landing. And
wrong one.
Next time, we have, who do we have? We have
Tyrion. We have Tyrion.
We have Arya and Daenerys.
I was going to say, we're due for a Daenerys chapter.
Yeah, because it's been a while since, because, yeah, all, she just married Khal Drogo. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Alrighty then. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media. Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and Sophia Mare _pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mayer Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mayer Studios podcast.